C1R.
Number 10A.
We come to the next question. What is man? And it is in the category of Christianity as Christ in Christian Science. And actually, if we wouldn't know what is in this question, or what the question is at all, I think we could somehow calculate spiritually what Mrs. Eddy would have to present here. If it is on the level of Christian Science, which has to do with the relationship of the divine with the human, if it is Christianity, which is at the point of universe and man, and which is in the category of the Christ, which should be saving, then we would find certainly that here Mrs. Eddy must present how a right idea of man would save us from a wrong concept of man. Wouldn't that be logical? Huh? Shall I go over it again? All right. We are in the category of Christian Science. What is the level of Christian Science? The relationship between the divine and the human. Yes? You know that now from the levels. So that it must be a question that has to do with that. Now we narrow down that category by seeing it is Christianity. So it must be something that has to do with man and the universe, because that's the point of Christianity. Yes? Is that clear? And it must have something to do with the Christ, because we are in that category of the Christ, and the Christ is always that which saves and heals at the point of the level of Christian Science. Yes? So if we put all that together, we would see that here she would have to present how a false sense of Christianity, false sense of man, is saved, naturally saved through the right concept of Christianity or man. So that we will witness here how the true idea of man, Christianity, has within itself a Christ. What does that Christ at the level of Christian Science? It saves and heals us from a wrong concept of man. So, if we read here the answer to what is man, we should somehow get that aspect. Now, up to this point, I was always just more or less telling what is in the text, summarizing it perhaps through the seven subtones, never really proving very closely to you that my findings are right and conclusive, never really showing how I arrive at these conclusions. And so today we will take the whole text of that answer, and I'm going to read it to you, not the text, but I'm going to read to you what I think when I read the text, so as to point out the way I try to bring back the text to the categories. We have shown that what we have to do is actually to take the illustrations, namely to take the, what we said, the fishes and the bananas and the elephants, and reduce them to the two and two, to the categories of computation, and only in that way we really find the scientific answer of it. So, it is helpful very often for the student just to see what goes on in a mind when a mind is reading a text and constantly classifies what one reads into the divine system of reference, therefore classifies it into the seven, classifies it into the four, and into the levels. So this may be a help. I have done that more extensively on the West Coast, and it has been a great help to the student. So I will do it here with some questions. So we take the textbook on page 475, and all what I want to do now is to read word by word, but also speaking out aloud what I think. And that thinking should actually not be an inspired thinking that is individually subjective, because that everybody can do, but that isn't science. That doesn't give a scientific interpretation, that gives a subjective interpretation. But here we have to do with a textbook, with a principle that interprets itself, not as a person that interprets something, so that the interpretation should always be so that it refers back to the system, so that the interpretation is system intrinsic and not subjectively inspired. Because that everybody can do, and because everybody has his own individual inspiration, but that never touches really reality, that never touches really the principle as principle did interpret itself through the system. We know that the whole chapter here is showing how principle interprets itself and reveals itself through the system of principle, and therefore we must stick to the system and give a system intrinsic interpretation. All right, so I start and read the text. The question is, what is man? This really is a very interesting question, because each one of us really wants to know what man is, and so we are quite in a state of expectancy, and without being in a state of expectancy, we are actually not a scientist, because a scientist, when he researches, he's always in a state of expectancy. He never really has a sense that he knows already all, and that he's just going over the old stuff again. He always has a sense, I wonder what I see more, I wonder what will be revealed more to me. And so he has a sense that those poor in spirit, that they really will see something new. So the answer is, man is not matter. So I begin to realize, oh, here she begins to depict man first in the category of the negatives, what he is not. And I learned first that man is not matter. And something says within me, oh, she is taking up the point of spirit, because matter is the counterfeit of spirit, and wants to show me something about the nature of man as the opposite of matter. So I say, okay, man is not matter. He is not. Oh, again a not, again a negative, made up of brain, blood, bones, and other material elements. And so again I feel here, she just explains further what she means by saying that man is not matter, gives some synonymous term for matter, just elaborating the same concept, namely that he is not brain, blood, bones and other material elements, which really seems to constitute the material body. So in this way, I already have a key tone that apparently Mrs. Eddy here wants to bring out, that man is not the counterfeit of spirit, he is not matter. So I keep that pedal note of spirit in my spiritual ear, and I'm wondering if she's going on to play on that pedal note further, or if she changes the tone. So the scripture informs us that man is made in the image and likeness of God. And so I feel, oh, now she's telling us the positive sense about what she has said before. So it is a juxtaposition of man not being matter, therefore man being what? The image and likeness of God. Oh yes, the image and likeness of God. Matter is not that likeness. All right, so she reasons very logically that if man is the likeness of God, and naturally I know that the likeness of God is spirit, because spirit is that which always reflects itself as the like, and I begin to realize that matter, which is not that likeness. So the likeness of spirit, here we get it now, the likeness of spirit cannot be so unlike spirit. And I really feel this is all one logical reasoning, line of reasoning, all along just one simple point, namely to prove that man is not matter. If he is the likeness of God, the likeness of spirit, he cannot be unlike spirit, and therefore he cannot be matter. Perhaps my eye goes to the side note at this moment, perhaps not, saying fleshly factors unreal, and I think, oh, this is even a more additional strengthening of the fact of that man is spirit. These fleshly factors, they're really brain, blood, bone, and other material elements. These are the fleshly factors, and she says those are unreal. Well, this is a new point. Up to now, she just has said that man is the likeness of spirit, therefore not matter. And now in the side note, she even gives an indication that this likeness of spirit must be the real, or at least she says that that unlikeness is unreal, giving me a hint that only the spiritual man can be the real man. Which brings me already to a kind of insight that says, now what did I gain up to this point? It says this is actually all about man from the point of view of spirit. She hasn't taken in anything else, but really the question, what is his substance? Is that substance matter or is it spiritual? And even saying that matter is unreal, so that I get the sense that only that man which is spirit is real. Then I read on, the likeness of spirit, we said that, cannot be so unlike spirit. Then I read on, still wondering what is there still in that long paragraph after he has already pointed out very clearly the substantiality, the spiritual substance of man, that she says man is spiritual. So this is the first time that she says man is spiritual, but I could easily expect that from what she has been saying before about the likeness of spirit. So that matter is not that likeness, therefore the likeness must be spiritual, so man is spiritual and perfect. Well, this is a new idea. This is of another category, to be perfect. Now, suddenly after a long tonality, all he brings in that spiritual is also perfect. Naturally, I know perfection has to do with love, and I'm expectant to see now what is she going to tell us about that man that is spiritual and at the same time perfect. So I'm again quite excited about what has to come. And because he is spiritual, yes, she said that before, and perfect, yes, she has that said before, he must be understood, he must be so understood in Christian Science. So I begin to realize that what she says here, that it is just a blunt statement about man is spiritual and perfect, but that I must understand what that means, spiritual perfection. That this is not just a saying, that I must know what that perfection is, what constitutes perfection. And I wonder if she's going to tell me or if she's not going to tell me. I don't know at this moment. And therefore I read on, still wondering what's coming. And she says, man is idea. Oh, this is new. Man is idea. That's the tone of mind, I say to myself. Now she begins actually to explain to me what this man is. She has said it must be understood, but how on earth do I know what it is? So here she gives me an indication that man is idea, the image of love. Oh, how interesting. I'm a bit surprised at this moment. She doesn't say man is the idea of mind or the image of mind. She says of love. And I know that love is always that synonymous term which demands a complete, perfect idea. So I feel, oh, man is an idea that apparently is an image of all the seven synonymous terms of the perfection, the fulfilled sense of love, not just an idea in mind. He is not physique. Yes, yes, that she has said before. She has said man is not matter. So if she says man is not matter or man is not physique, that's more or less the same thing. So she just wants to stress again idea versus physique. That we are now really aware that now man is not a physique, but idea, and that physique is not an idea, so that I really see that very clearly. What then is he? And so she goes on and says, he is the compound idea of God. Uh-huh. I say, this is a new idea. This is now saying that man is not only just idea, not only that he is not physique, therefore he must be spiritual, that he is a spiritual idea. What kind of a spiritual idea is he? He is a compound idea of God, including all right ideas. And this gives me always a sense of the reflection of spirit, where all ideas reflect themselves at the focal point of spirit and giving a compound idea. And I begin to see, oh, that's the reason why she said he is not physique, because she wants to bring out the spiritual nature much clearer of that idea, that man is not just idea, but that it is the infinite reflection of spirit as a compound idea, including all right ideas, and therefore it gives me already a sense that she is building up here the term man, the perfect man, first saying at the point of mind it is idea, an image, at the point of spirit that is spiritual and not physique, and that that spiritual is actually the compound of all ideas, each idea reflecting every other idea at the point of spirit. I go on, and she tells me further that he is the generic term for all that reflects God's image and likeness. That's new. I begin to realize now that the generic term, man, is at the point of soul, because soul identifies itself generically. There is only one generic man. There are not many generic men. It's just one identity, man. And I begin to realize that she is here really bringing out the tone of soul, the generic term for all that reflects what? God's image and likeness. And I know from my other studies of the textbook that usually when Mrs. Eddy wants to bring out the term identity, that she puts it in this language, namely as image and likeness. From the whole textbook, I am aware that man as God's image is really the image of mind, that man at the point of being the likeness of God is the likeness of spirit. But when both go together, if I have an image that is absolutely alike the original, then both together always give me a sense of true identity. That is generic man. That man here is the generic term as the identity of God's idea. So I have already built up quite a nice sense of man, what constitutes man, first as idea, second as a compound idea of the reflection of spirit, three, that this idea is a generic term as the identity of God, that it has all what God has too. And still there is a semicolon. I see that she wants to go on telling me something about man. I come to the conscious identity of being as found in science. Now that identity of soul apparently is rooted in science, is found in science, that gives me always a sense of principle, that everything is brought back to its principle and founded there in principle, in which man is the reflection of God or mind, and therefore is what? Eternal. That's new. Again, I come to the point, then man is also eternal. The moment he is found in science, that we have always seen, the moment we put something into science, into principle, then that principle is eternal life. So I get the sense that therefore he is eternal, that he is that which, and that intrigues me. At this moment, she does not speak anymore, he is. Like she did on line 14, he is the compound idea man. Once I have seen that the idea is put back into principle as an eternal idea, we get rid of the personal pronoun, because principle does not know any person and is therefore an impersonal fact in being, namely a that which has no separate mind from God. This gives me a further concept of the indivisibility from God or individuality of God, so that man is individual, inseparable, undivided from principle, a sense of life. I go on, that which, so she has dropped entirely the he which. The he is. It's just that which has not a single quality underived from deity. That's not the single quality underived from deity. So I feel, well, then man has everything that God has. Didn't I find that in the sixth day of creation, that man really has, is the image and likeness of God, has everything that God has, that he is the heir of God as a son of truth, that he has all the qualities, therefore his true form, his true manhood constitutes of the divine qualities, and I begin to see the whole stature of manhood here, of divine manhood here. Then I go on, and it says, that which, again it's that which, possesses no life, intelligence, nor creative power of his own. So that's a negative statement. He has nothing of his own. From where does he have it? But reflects spiritually all that belongs to his Maker. And I get the sense of the love of God, of the allness of God, of the coexistence with God, the unity with God. He reflects spiritually just all that belongs to his Maker. And that brings me to an end of a paragraph. So I say to myself, now, what did Mrs. Eddy actually now tell us in that paragraph? That she would tell us, first of all, the keynote of that paragraph, that man is not matter, that man is spiritual, the likeness of spirit, never material. And therefore, we ask ourselves now, what is the nature of spiritual man? And then she runs right through the seven and says that nature of the spiritual man is a perfect nature. What makes up perfection? It is the idea of mind, is the compound reflection and idea of spirit, is the generic term or identity of God. He is fixed in principle, found in science. He is eternal and individual, inseparable from God. He has inherited all the qualities of God, and therefore, at the point of love, everything belongs to man, what belongs to God. And I get a very good picture already of what is the spiritual idea, man.